We are holding on Chof Amud Aleph about a third of the way down the line we can do Matnas. So to recap, we had a Mishnah that said two different dinim. One was one which many Rishonim say we shouldn't be gurus, is that the Tanakhama said you're not allowed to make jewelry for Avodah Zarah, and Rabbi Eliezer says you are if you're being paid for it, which many Rishonim, Tosfos, and many others ask how is that even possible, and they take out the whole thing. And the second one was that you're not allowed to sell them anything, you're not allowed to sell a goy anything attached to the ground, like trees or whatever, but you're allowed to sell them it after it's chopped down, and Rabbi Huda said you could even sell something to them that's already attached on condition, as long as it's a sale, on condition that they will cut it, that they will chop it down as soon as they get it. Which led us into a discussion, why should that be? We said, because you have a pasuk that says loisachonim. And we said the word loisachonim has three different meanings. It means, the simple meaning is loisitin lahem chen, don't give them grace. In other words, for example, as the Gemara will say later on, don't say how handsome or how beautiful is this guy. A second meaning of it, which is relevant to our Mishnah, is leistitam hem chanoya bakarka. Don't give them the ability to establish a permanent place in the land. And like
by
this, by selling them something that's attached to the ground or the ground itself. If you can't sell them anything that's attached to the ground, you can't sell them houses or fields or trees or whatnot. Then at most, they're only going to live in the area temporarily.
This is primarily you cannot appeal up a shittach of land to a goy.
Hold on, that's what we're going to discuss. That's exactly what we're going to discuss in a little bit in connection with our Mishnah and more in connection with the next Mishnah. We'll also see to what extent it applies in Eretz Yisrael versus Chutz Laaretz. We'll get to all that. And then a third meaning of Loisachonim, we said, was Loisitin Lahem Matnas Chinam. Don't give them a free gift. Okay. This, by the way, I That's a different thing, it says in the Torah. A free gift, by the way, would mean, were you giving it to them for no particular purpose? Were you giving it to them in order to establish goodwill with them, or because you owe them a favor, or whatever, that's different. This that we mentioned in the Mishnah, by the way, about not making jewelry for Avodah Zarah, and Rabbi Eliezer saying, B'schar Mutter, and this that all the Rishonim ask on it, how is that possible? There is something interesting that I saw from that Rabbi Zevin brings from Rabbi Herzog, the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel. He wants to say that maybe actually the word in the Mishnah is not supposed to be La'avodas Kechavim, but rather La'oivedas Kechavim, meaning for a goita. In which case, it fits very well with the second part of the Mishnah. We're saying, Leisitin Lahem Chain. We said there's three things that we learned from Leisachonim. One of them is Leisitin Lahem Chain. Don't do something that'll make them appear graceful in your eyes. So therefore, that would include making jewelry for them. And Rabbi Eliezer is saying, if you're doing it for schar, so therefore you're not doing it in order to make them look beautiful. You're doing it because your job, you're a goldsmith or whatever, and this is your job, then it would be motive. And he says that that's how you can reconcile it. Okay. Fine. The Mishnah says, the Gemara says rather, Umatnas chinam gufo tanoi. Now this that we're saying, that one of the meanings of loisachonim is you're not allowed to give a free gift to a goy, is actually the subject of a machlokes tanoim, whether that is indeed the case. The Tanya, as we learn in the Braisa, now you have a pasuk that says like this, look in the side over here, Torah Rashalom Beis. Loisachol kol nevela, don't eat any nevela. Lager Hashem Yisharecha titnenu v'achola. So the ger, meaning a ger, is not a ger tzedek, obviously, means a ger tosha, who's accepted Shem Mitzvah Mei Noyachan himself. To the ger that lives in your city, titnenu, you can give it v'achola, and he'll eat it. Oy mocher lenochri, or sell it to a goy, meaning an ovid avodah zarah. The rest of it we're not quoting. The rest of the pasuk we're not quoting in our Gemara. So what does it mean? The pasuk says, "Loisoichlu kol nevela, lagera shebesharecha titnenu va'achola oy mocher benachri." You should not eat any nevela. To the ger toshav that lives in your cities, because that's why he's called a ger toshav, because he has the right of residence in Eretz Yisrael. If he's an oved avodah zarah, he's not allowed to live in Eretz Yisrael. So a ger toshav who lives in your cities, titnenu, you can give it va'achola and he'll eat it oy mocher benachri, or you sell it to a goy. So, based on that, Ainli Alola Gerbin Asino over Khabi Machira. Based on that, you would only know that when it comes to a Ger Toshav, it has to be you give it to him, you're not allowed to sell it to him. And when it comes to a regular run of the mill guy who worships Avodah Zarah, you could only sell it to him. Based on the wording of the passage, that's what it seems. Where do we know that you could equally well sell it to the Ger Toshav? You're not obligated to give it to him. You're allowed to sell it to him.
If you can already do the Nakhi, to make Kavachomer, you certainly can to get Torah.
Not necessarily. Maybe the Torah Davka wants that. Maybe the Torah Davka wants that you should give it to the. Maybe the Torah Davka wants that you should give it to a Ger Torah. Hold on. Maybe the idea is the Torah wants you to be nice to the Ger Torah and give it to him for free. So how do we know that not? Talmud Loimer Titnena Oy Mocher. Because the pasuk puts the two verbs titneno, you should give it, and oy mocher, you or sell it, you can it puts it together, which means that we can repunctuate the pasuk la gera shebisharecha titneno va'achola oy mocher to the ger who lives in your city, you can give it and he'll eat it, or you can sell it.
Implying
the period after oy mocher, right? And the reason is again because since you have the two verbs are next to each other, the Gemara does this kind of thing in a few other places. Gemara does this kind of thing in a few other places also, that when we have like this, it could have phrased it instead in each one, the noun and the verb, It could have said like Gera Sheba Sharacha Titnena Velanochri Timkireno or something like that. Instead it puts Titnena Vachola Oimacho together. So therefore we can understand that we can darshan it to mean that they both refer to the Ger. What about Ovid Kechavim in a Sinaminayin? What about where do we see that you're allowed to give it for free to the Ovid Kechavim? Same thing. Same thing. We can put the period before the word titnena. So now the titnena and the oimacho refer to the goy, to the nachri. So it comes out the bottom line.
Do that to be either one way or another?
No, because the fact that the pasuk phrased it that way, the fact that again that Hashem could have written it like Ger Hashem Bisharecha Tznena Vachala or Lenochri Timkarena or something like that, and then it would mean it's only one for one and only one for the other. The fact that it puts the two verbs between the two nouns, you have the noun like Ger, the verb Tznena, the verb Vachala, the noun Lenochri, allows us to darshan that both verbs apply to each one of the nouns, that the titnena v'achola can refer to the ger or it can refer to the goy.
How can you get two meanings?
But that's because that's why the pasuk is phrased that way, to show that it can be read each of those ways.
It can.
Well, that's the very mayor. That's what the mayor says. Therefore, in fact, the Gemara is going to say in a few lines that the mayor has a very good point. So yes, that's a valid way of darshaning a pasuk. So therefore, according to the mayor, the bottom line is you can give it to the ger or you can sell it to him. You can give it to the goy or you can sell it to him. So there we see that the mayor is allowing you to give a free gift to a goy, which is what we were saying. That's the machlokes of Tanoim. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Dvarim Kiksavan. Rabbi Yehuda says no. It's exactly what it says in the pasuk. We're not darshaning. We're not repunctuating it. A ger toshav. You can give it to him. You're not supposed to sell it to him. An Ovid Kechavim, a goy who worships Avodah Zarah, you have to sell it to him. Yeah. The halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda, but the point is, at least we see that there is a machlokes on him. Okay, so the question is, Shapir Kamer of Meir, doesn't a Meir have a good point? The way the pasuk is phrased implies that you could learn it either of those two ways. And by the way, I mean, you're saying you can't darshan a pasuk in two different ways. Tosfos actually refers over here to a Gemara elsewhere that talks about you have a number of psukim where you have like that. You have a word in a pasuk where it's not so clear whether it belongs to the first half of the pasuk or the second half.
Does it belong to both?
Sometimes, as a matter of fact, for example, one of them involves the description of the menorah, or the menorah abog vi mishukodim kaftareo frachayo, that the goblets of the menorah the menorah has goblets, mishukodim, they're decorated with almond shapes, kaftareo frachayo, it's knobs and it's flowers. So which one does it mean? Are the goblets decorated or are the knobs and the flowers? And actually, I believe that Amman Paskins, that all of them are, because he understands, therefore, that the word Mishkodim can go to either one. So similarly over here. Okay. Fine. So Shapir Kamer of Meir, doesn't a Meir have a good point? Rabbi Yehuda, Amalach, so what does Rabbi Yehuda answer to you? He says, Yisakadaydach Kamer of Meir. Fine, but if you were to think that the Pasuk means the way Rabbi Meir says it, that you can dash in it either way, and therefore that you can give it or sell it to either the Ger Toshav or the Goy, then lichter rachmana titnena va'achola u'macher. Then the pasuk should have said rather lagera shabbat sharach titnena va'achola u'macher, where the vav could mean or instead of oimacher. The vav could mean or it could mean and. So if it said u'macher, then we could understand it. We could darshan it that it can mean or it can mean and therefore we would be able to understand that it means that you can equally well give it and sell it to one or the other.
That's true.
Oilamali, why does it say or? So that shows that the pasuk is breaking it up into two things. It's one thing for the Ger Toshav to give it to him, or a different thing selling it to the guy, not near to the other kachavim, not mixing them around. Vera Meir, now what would the mayor answer to that? He would say, "Have hulak dumin the sin of the ger the mechira the oved kachavim." He would say, "Yes, that." But what the reason why it uses the word er, the reason why it uses the word oi, not like you, Rabbi Yehuda, are arguing because it wants to tell us you can't sell it to the ger toshav or give it to the goy, but rather because the pasuk wants to inform you which one should take precedence. If you have a choice between giving it to the ger toshav or selling it to the goy, better you should give it to the ger toshav. Therefore, the pasuk mentions oi to imply you should do this. If you can't do that, or if you can't do this, then do that. Tosfos asked the question. So what? I mean, what's the logic? Why are we going to make the guy? Why are we going to make the guy suffer a loss? Why should he be obligated to give it away to the ger toshav for free? So Tosfos says this isn't a general rule. Here we're talking about specifically in Nevela. It's not something you could sell to another Jew, because what would another Jew do with it? He can't eat it either. You don't have very many Ovid Kachavim around anyway. Whereas,
only about
a Nevela? That word in the Pasuk is talking about a Nevela. Called Nevela, like Erashav Asharacha, etc. So, if it was something that you could have sold it to a Yisrael, then fine, no problem. You're allowed to sell it to a Yisrael. You're not obligated to give it away for free to a Ger Toshav. But here, where Yisrael can't use it anyway, an Ovid Kachavim, you don't have very many, because you're not supposed to have any Ovid Kachavim in Eretz Yisrael. A Ger Toshav, to him, it's the same as any other meat, because it's worth just as much as kosher meat. To him, there's no difference between kosher and nevela. So therefore you should give it to him, rather than anyway, the major alternative would anyway be to you wouldn't really have a goy available to sell it to anyway, so therefore preferably you should give it to the Ger Toshav, even if there happens to be right now around an Ovid Kachavim who you could have sold it to. But that Tosfos is saying that doesn't apply across the board. This is a special case. Okay, anyway, so that's what the mayor argues. The oy is coming to tell us what the order of preference is.
We're talking about just general gifts, not land in particular.
No, right. We're talking about in general, right. We're talking about this is what we said, that you can't give the matnas chinam applies in general to gifts, right. So again, when there's a purpose to the gift, for example, because again, you owe him one or whatever, then that's different. Or when you're doing it in order to gain his goodwill or whatever, here we're talking about just a gift for the sake of a gift. Yeah. All right. Rabbi Yehuda, what would Rabbi Yehuda answer to that? He would say, you don't need the pasuk to tell us that. Even to ger after mitzvah lachiyos. So since a ger toshav in general, you have a din, the Torah mentions elsewhere that you have a mitzvah to help keep him alive. That, for example, if he's poor, you have an actual mitzvah d'oraisa to give him tzedakah or a loan or what have you. The pasuk is that you have a what's the lashon v'chiyomachok or mati yavi imach v'achzakdebo. Then you should support him ger v'soshav v'chayimach. Even if he's a ger toshav, and it says v'chayimach, he should live among you, meaning that you have to make it possible for him to live to support him. Right. As opposed to, in other words, when it comes to goyim ov davar zara who are poor, so we have dirabanim nedar kesholim, then you give him tzedakah, but not d'oraisa. Here with a ger toshav, you have an actual mitzvah d'oraisa to help keep him alive. And we'll see also a relevance of that in the next parak. We'll talk about what the dinim of saving lives of goyim versus ger toshav versus whatever.
Do you have a din of ger toshav today without becoming this?
Technically, no, because actually the strict definition of a ger toshav is that can only take place bisman shah yovel noyeg. It can only take place when yovel is in effect, and yovel hasn't been in effect since toward the end of the first day of Mikdash. And nevertheless, you have Rishonim and Achronim will argue that Goyim nowadays will basically accept the ideas behind Shavnus of Nenayach and who do accept them because Hashem said so. They may not be considered technical Geirat Toshav, but maybe they can be included because Yovel is not knowing, but nevertheless, maybe when it comes to some of these dinim, maybe we can give them the status of it. Okay. Anyway. So therefore, sort of Yehuda says, since a ger, you have a mitzvah lachiyosa to help keep him alive, to support him, uknani, or it's a change of the sense, or it's supposed to be ovitichovim, iyat a mitzvah lachiyosa, so him, you don't have a mitzvah to help keep alive, therefore, lahaktim leitzarachro, you don't need a pasuk to tell you that it's preferable to give it to the ger toshav rather than to sell it to the goy, because by giving it to the ger toshav, you're accomplishing the mitzvah of v'chayimach. So therefore, he says, you don't need the oy for that purpose. Right. Says Rabbi Yehuda, what must the oy in our pasuk be coming to tell us? That it's only one or the other. It's only selling it to the goy or giving it to the ger toshav, not mix and match. So therefore, he says, therefore,
there's no error in there. Wants an extra pasuk.
So that's the thing. The mayor would say, okay, yes, you have a mitzvah l'achiyoseh, but nevertheless, you wouldn't realize from that that it still means that you should prefer to give it for free to a ger tosha rather than sell it to an oved kochavim. So therefore, you still need the oy in the pasuk to tell us that. Okay. Fine. Then we said, Dava achar leischonim leisitin lahem chayim. Then we said another meaning of leischonim, we said before, is leisitin lahem chayim. Don't give them grace, meaning don't say how graceful or beautiful they are. So Messiah le Rav. This supports what Rav said. The Omer Rav also Adam Shiyem Kamenoy Vedes Kechavimzu. A person is not allowed to say how beautiful is this goita, because that would be giving them chayim. Okay.
Even.
What do you mean even? That's, you're not allowed to say it after Rav is saying. So the question.
You're not allowed to say to them.
No, it means among ourselves. Pashtos also. Some of them.
If you talk about
among ourselves, because you're saying that a goy is someone beautiful. You're saying that an oved kochavim is someone beautiful. Someone that you look up to, that you want to emulate or whatever. Some mafoshim say, by the way, that maybe after they're dead, you're allowed to praise them. We have for example, we know that we know the famous Gemara where it says about Dama ben Nesina that he's the great exemplar of kibud av v'aim, and you know so. But, we're telling that long after he's dead, so that's a little bit different than when he's alive. Meister, the Gemara says, I have a contradiction though. Meister, but of Shimon Gamliel, Shahoya Gavin Maila Bahara Bayis. It happened once that Reb Shimon Gamliel was on one of the steps of the standing on one of the steps of the Harabayis. And he saw a very beautiful goita, very beautiful goyish lady. Omar, and he says, Morabu. A goy is allowed to go into certain parts of the Beis Mikdash. They're allowed to go into the Harabayis, but it's not allowed to go past the Chil. They're allowed to go into the Harabayis. They're allowed to go until the Sorig, the low wooden fence that you have surrounding the Chil. There were actually signs on it. They found a couple of them in archaeological digs. There were signs on them that actually said no goyim are allowed to go past this point. Yeah. They found in the 1800s when they were doing archaeological digs around the Harabayis. Yeah, they found a couple of such signs. Anyway. So Rav Shimon Gamliel sees this very beautiful goita, Omar, and he says, Morabu Masech Hashem, how great are your works, Hashem. So on the face of it, then you are allowed to speak in praise of them. There is a vart, by the way, from the Mezuzah Magid, the deeper idea behind this. He says that Rav Shimon Gamliel was on Maila Bahara Bayis, implying like he's on a very high level in Rukhiyas, and all of a sudden he sees a goita, so he thinks to himself, why did Hashem make it that I should have to see her? It must be because I should be taking the beauty that I saw and sublimating it and being Maila to Kedusha and express from it the high level of Kedusha. Similar thing to what they say, the famous thing they say about the Rashi, when Rashi describes about the ephod over there, he describes about the type of apron that women, that noble women wear when they ride. You have the famous story that they tell that Rashi was once walking by and saw a noble woman riding on her horse, and he's bothered, why should I have to see something like that, which is not so sneistic, until he came to be writing about the Mishkan, about the Big Kahuna, and then he thinks to himself, now I realize why Hashem made me have to see that, so that I would see the apron that she's wearing and have an idea how to describe the apron. So this would be a similar idea. Okay. Anyway.
Without seeing her,
he wouldn't be able to picture it. As easily. Yeah. Okay. But after Rabbi Akiva raw Eshes Turnus Rufus HaRosha, also we find that Rabbi Akiva saw the wife of Turnus Rufus HaRosha, the governor of Eretz Yisrael at that time, Rok Sochach Uvacha, and when he saw her, he spit, he laughed, and he cried. Rock, he spit, shoyta bomiti basucha, because to remind himself, and maybe to remind her as well, look, as beautiful as you are, you came from a putrid drop, from a snubby drop of shechmas zera, like everybody else, don't hold of yourself so highly. In fact, elsewhere it talks about, I think it's a Gemara or a Medrash or something, that actually Turnus Rufus had sent her to try and seduce Rabbi Akiva. So when he saw her, he needed to show her that. Therefore, he had to underscore that, no, I don't care about your beauty, I want nothing to do with it, and then he spit. Sochak, he laughed, that did him a guide of a Nosotla, because he saw with Ruach HaKodesh that eventually she is going to become a Giyotis, and he, Rabbi Akiva, is going to marry her. In fact, the Gemara tells us in the Dorim that there are six sources from which Rabbi Akiva became rich. One of them is he got the money from Kabbal Savua, his father-in-law. We know that whole story. One of the ones is over here, that Turnus Rufus eventually dropped dead, and his wife was Miss Geyer and married Rabbi Akiva, and she brought in the whole fortune that she had inherited from her husband. bacha, and he cried, Dahai shufra bali akra, that eventually this beauty is going to be rotting away in the dust. The point being, you know, exactly what it sounds like, as beautiful as she is after she dies, after 120, Anyway, the point, so, okay, some of the Mephoshim say that really the Gemara is not bringing in Rabbi Akiva so much to argue about this point, about not saying how beautiful a Goethe is. He didn't say how beautiful she is. It's just, well, while we're mentioning beautiful Goethe, we mention a similar thing. The main question is from Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who sees a Goethe and says, Merava Masach Hashem. So Rav, so what would Rav answer to all of that? He would say, Oidu Yehuda Kamoide. That's different. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is thanking Hashem that he created such a beautiful thing in his world. He's not praising the guy. He's thanking Hashem. The Amamar is, in fact, learning a blaisa. Haroya Briyas Tovus, if somebody sees beautiful creatures, and in fact, Tovus says it doesn't just mean human beings. It means even a particularly beautiful animal. Oyma Baruch Shekacha Baruch Ba'olama. A person should say a bracha, blessed is Hashem who created, who has such things, or Shekacha Loi Ba'olama is how it says in Shulchan Aruch, that he has such things in his world.
Shekacha
Loi Ba'olama is how it's brought in Shulchan Aruch. Nowadays, we're not usually noyig to say such a bracha because it's a very subjective thing. Is this really the most beautiful of its kind or whatever? Yeah, so, okay.
Or like say a bracha on a king.
You say a bracha on a king, that's different because any king who has a certain power, you say, but but that's the point is some of these more subjective brachas like that we're not necessarily so noyig to say nowadays like this one. Okay. Anyway, so the point is, so that's different. He's doing it in order to praise Hashem by saying Morabo Masach Hashem, or by saying the bracha Shekacha Lo Bar Lomay. That's different than praising the Goy himself. Again, with Tosis's point, the same way as you would say the same bracha if you saw a particularly beautiful animal. You're not praising the animal. You're praising Hashem for creating the animal. Yeah. Okay. Fine. The question is, well, is Takuli Mishari? Still, are you telling me that you're b'chlal allowed to look at a Goyish woman? Most of them, of course, explain that at least the coolie doesn't mean a casual glance. It means more like to stare at, enough to be able to notice them, in other words. The smear, I think, actually wants to say that at least the coolie means even to look briefly. Most of the other acronym disagree with him. Anyway, Mace, the Gemara says, I have a contradiction.
Well, the sakil means more.
So that's the thing. The smear, I'm sure Hanaro argues that maybe it means even a brief glance.
And
he argues that they stack on the brief glance, and lirois would mean a longer look.
Lahabit,
I guess, would also be a long gaze. I don't know. Most of the other mafoshim, most of the other achronim disagree with the smay on that and say the other way around. Anyway, okay.
The
stack would be longer, and lirois would be a short glance. Okay. Mesvig Gemara says, I have a contradiction. A posik says, a brisa says that when you have a posik that says, "Nishmarta mikol davar ra," you should guard yourself from any evil thing. What does that mean? Shall you stackle adam beishana, that a person should not stare after, should not look at, whatever, a beautiful woman. A man should not look at a beautiful woman because it'll bring him to hear her. Vafilu pnuya, even if she's unmarried. Now you do have the exception, which is in halacha, that you're going out on a date or something. You look at her to see if it's different, but not even then, not to stare at her.
Why does she have to be beautiful? Why?
Because
if she's not beautiful, you may.
One second. And if she's a married woman, doesn't matter, even if she's ugly, because she's off limits. In other words, the point is, if she's a pnuya, if she's not an eshes ish, if she's not particularly beautiful, okay, look, in principle, you are allowed to be attracted to her. You are allowed to get married, after all. But if she's beautiful, if she's an ish or not, then you're likely to have a hero from her. Whereas when an eshes ish, it doesn't matter whether she's beautiful or not. Either way, she's off limits. Fine. So that's
then she's not eshes ish. You should. It wouldn't make any difference whether or not she's beautiful or she's not beautiful.
No, because that's the thing. If she's not as beautiful, you're not necessarily going to be so attracted to her. And even if you are, look, in principle, you could marry her. It is a higher level to not even do that. The Gemara mentions elsewhere that Pasuk from Iyov, that he says, "Bris karati la'enu mo'at banan al-basula," that he praises himself, that I never even looked at her at any basula. But yeah, okay. Anyway. The loib vigdei seva shalisha, continues the braisa. Also, you're not allowed to look at the colorful clothes of a woman, because as the Gemara is going to say later on, we're talking about ones where you know the woman who wears these clothes at other times. So then you see the clothes even when they're not on her. It makes you think of her and it makes you have hear her. Also, you shouldn't be looking at a male and female donkey or a male and female chazir or bird when they're mating, because that also leads to hero. So all of this is included in the Nishmarta Mikol Davar Ra, that you should stay away from a bad thing, because all of these things can bring to Tehiru, which is a bad thing. Even if a person is as full of eyes as the Malach HaMavet, which is a few different meanings, there's a few different explanations in that. One explanation is it means even if, one of them is that it's a figure of speech. Even if a person has eyes all over the place, so like wherever he's turning, he can't help looking, nevertheless he's obligated to not to look. A Gemara along similar lines in Bava Basra that says, for example, that if a man walks by a riverbank where women are washing clothes, even if there's no other way to go, and therefore of necessity, he has to walk in that direction, he should still be averting his eyes, he should still be turning his eyes in a different direction rather than look at them with their legs uncovered as they're doing the laundry. So that's one explanation. Another explanation of it is Mole Enayim. Means even if a person has seen this kind of thing many times before, so you would think by now he's desensitized to it. Nevertheless, he still has an obligation to not look. So what do we mean that full of eyes like the Malach HaMavet? So the Gemara digresses. So we're still in the middle of the question. Again, the question is how Rav Shimon Gamliel could look at this goita in order to praise Hashem if we're saying that you're not allowed to look at a beautiful woman if she's unmarried or any woman if she's married. So we'll get back to that, but first the Gemara is digressing.
Can we give an explanation?
No, we said before that there's a difference between praising her and praising Hashem. But now we have a more general question. How could he even notice her long enough to notice that she's beautiful to praise Hashem if you're not supposed to look in the first place?
Spiritually, he saw she was going to...
No. Because you don't say Shekach Alai Bai Lama on somebody who's spiritually beautiful. You say it on somebody who's physically beautiful. Yeah. Okay, so but first we're going to digress a minute. This that we mentioned, the expression Mole Enayim to Malach HaMavet, so we're going to digress a minute to describe the Malach HaMavet a little bit. Omru Olaval Malach HaMavet, they say about the Malach HaMavet, Shekule Mole Enayim, he's all full of eyes. In what sense is he full of eyes? So again, you have a number of different explanations. One of them is that it means he's always looking, that he's always looking around. There are always people who Hashem has decided it's their time to die, and so he's looking around to find them, so to speak. There's also an idea.
He has to look.
Okay, you know, he's for to Nivra. He's for to a created being. He's not Hashem himself. So yeah, he has to look, so to speak. There's even a Gemara in Chagiga that mentions that he can conceivably make a mistake and take the wrong person. So yeah, in that sense, though, he has a lot of eyes because he has to always be looking around. They also talk about the Chassam Sofer brings on this something from his Rebbe of Nathan Adler that says that. When we say the Malach HaMavet is full of eyes, in the sense that we know that the eyes are the, we say every day, and we say every day in Krishna, the lois asuru achrei levavcham v'achrei eneichem, because the eyes are one of the big things that lead a person into avodas, as we're talking about over here, that a person sees things that he shouldn't be. And when a person sees those things, that gives more eyes, it gives more powers to the Malach HaMavet. And so that is, and eventually, therefore, the Gemara is going to continue a couple of lines from now that before a person dies, he opens up his mouth, representing the continuation of it. How the Malach HaMavet first come to human beings is from eating from the Eitz HaDaat. And in general, how does the Malach HaMavet, how does the Satan, who Yetzer Hara, who Satan, who Malach HaMavet, how do you have control over a person often through tithes of eating? So in that sense, you have a person sees something, the Medrash, the Gemara someplace talks about in connection with that pulse from Krishna, the Gemara someplace talks about that what happens, the eye sees, Rashi brings it on the pulse, the eye sees something, then the heart desires it, and then the body ends up carrying it out. And many such things include taivas of eating, the original taiva that humanity fell into with eating by the Chetei Tadat. So therefore, representing the idea over here, it starts off with the eyes, and therefore we're saying the Malach HaMavet is full of eyes. They have a lumdish joke, by the way, about the Rogachover, that he's also Molei Enayim, because his Svarim, a typical comment from the Rogachover and his Svarim on Rambam and whatever, will be eyeing this and eyeing this Gemara and eyeing that and whatever, looking this Gemara or that marker or whatever, and you'll find something that bears on the subject. So the joke is that he's also Molei Enayim. Okay. So the Malach HaMavet is calling Molei Enayim. It's all full of eyes. The shas p'tiros de shocholos, and when a person is sick and it's come time for him to pass away, omen mal merashoy, so the Malach HaMavet stands over the person's head, over the head of the bed, the chavish shlufa b'yadoy, his sword is drawn in his hand, the tipa shomara tzloyaboy, and there's a bitter drop hanging from the sword, kibin shchola royoy, so when the sick person sees the Malach HaMavet, mizazeya, he's startled, Active, so he opens up his mouth, and we see often before a person passes away, their muscles get slack and their mouth opens. The zirkel of seichpiv and the malachamavus then drips that bitter drop into the person's mouth. Mimena mest, from that the person dies. Mimena masriach, that's what causes his body to decay. Mimena panav merikos, and from that also the person's face becomes pale or greenish or whatever.
You're born from a drop, and you.
You're killed from a drop in that sense, yeah. The Maharal explains the deeper idea of what all Gemara means is when you get down to it, yes, a person is a human being, is a Nivra like any other Nivra, is a created being like any other, and it has a body like any other. On the other hand, a human being also has a Neshama that comes from Hashem. By right, it shouldn't be that a person should die at all. In fact, we learned back near the beginning of our parak about the question of whether humanity whether we would have been susceptible to death after Matan Torah if it hadn't been for the Chata Egel. Elsewhere, it talks about that the Adam and Chava and their descendants wouldn't have been susceptible to death if it weren't for the Eitz Hadas. So therefore, the Gemara over here is expressing the idea that in and of themselves, a person would never die and never decay, etc., only because of the what's represented by the Malach HaMavet, the destruction and whatever that's represented by the Malach HaMavet, the tumor that a person brings on themselves during their life causes these things to happen. Okay, anyway, the point is, getting back to the original point that we were saying, so we'll revisit this about the Malach HaMavet in a little bit, but meanwhile, to get back to the question that we had before, again, how did Rav Shimon Gamliel look at the Goita long enough to notice that she's beautiful, and for that matter, Rav Akiva looking at Turnus Ruch with his wife, if we're saying that you're not allowed to look at a woman? The answer is Keren Zovis. The answer is Keren Zovis, HaBoy. It was around a corner. Rav Shimon Gamliel, when we're saying he was on the Harabayit, he was turning around, he came around a corner, and all of a sudden there was a goita there, so he couldn't help but notice her. But yes, ordinarily, if it hadn't been for that, he wouldn't have noticed her, he wouldn't have seen her in the first place. Okay, getting back to Haloi Bevigdei Tzeva Shel Isha, getting back to, we said that you're not allowed to look at colorful clothing of a woman. It doesn't just mean when she's wearing them. It means even if they're hanging on the wall, you're still not allowed to look at them. Because again, like Rashi said at the top of the Amud, it evokes in your mind what she looked like when she was wearing them, and then it brings you to, and then it brings you to here. Amud a papa over makubale. And so the papa says that only applies if you know the person who wears them. Otherwise, if you stand to see a colorful dress hanging on a hanger or something, that doesn't matter. Amar Rava Dekanami, as a matter of fact, Rava says, yes, you can actually see that from the wording of the Braisa. Dekatani v'loi b'vigdei tseva isha, of shel isha actually, because it said, you're not supposed to look at the colorful clothing of a woman. V'loi katani v'loi b'vigdei tzivonin. It didn't just say don't look at colorful clothing, which would imply any colorful clothing. Specifically, it mentions shel isha, implying of an isha who you already know, or you've already seen before. So that proves that's the only thing it's talking about. When you know the person or when you've seen the person wearing them before. Obviously. Okay. So then Rav Chista says this is only talking about when they're old, when they've already been worn. So again, same idea. You already saw her wearing them one time. In other words, like this, what Rav Papa was saying with a makar ba'alehen, you would understand from that that it means that even if she wasn't wearing them previously, but you know the person who owns them. So a woman just bought a dress, for example, and you know that woman, then according to what Rav Papa is saying, it would sound like already you're also to look at it. So Rav Chista is clarifying that's not what it means. Hani mili ba'ti, we're only talking about where they're old. In other words, the garments have already been worn at least one time by her. But if they're new garments, she just bought them and has never worn them, then there's no problem to look at them. And he says you can prove it. Because if you weren't going to think like that, if you were going to think that you're not even allowed to look at the new ones, then you have to ask, Anan monol ashburi hechi yahabinam. Then how would we be allowed to give... So how would we be allowed to give clothes, the new clothes, when we give them to a laundry man to fix them up, to make them look nice or whatever before you start wearing them? How would you be allowed to? The laundry men a lot of times are men, You're giving them a new dress that that your wife just bought, for example, to fix up, to take off rashes is kovis, which means a laundry man. But yeah, it's true. A kovis is also responsible for taking out the extra threads that are in it and different things like that. Yeah, so okay.
Well, you could make an exception for
Well, on the face of it, there shouldn't be any exceptions. So how would we be allowed? How come a stacker lachoda is going to have to look at the garment? And the fact that we are allowed to obviously shows that there's a difference whether they were ever worn or not. However, the Gemara says not necessarily, because according to your own svara, you could argue back like this. What about Hada Amar Rabbi Yehuda? What about this that we know that Rabbi Yehuda said, min b'minoy mutu lahachnes k'mitcho b'shvetera? When it comes to a male and female animal of the same species, now with different species, you wouldn't be allowed to do this because it would be kalayim. But when you have the same species, a male and a female, you're allowed to stick in k'mitcho b'shveteret, to literally mitcho means an applicator for paint or for eyeshadow or whatever, and a shveteret is a tube that you take the eyeshadow out of, so you can imagine, you can understand what the nimshal means. In other words, you're actually allowed to insert the aver into where it's supposed to go. You have to ask, how would you be allowed to make a male and female animal mate? So how would you be allowed to hook a stackle? Huh? You have to be looking at it, and we said before, you're not supposed to look at animals when they're mating. Ella ba'avidte tarid. Obviously, the answer must be that it's different when he's occupied with his work, so then he's not thinking about a hirhu because he's busy with his work. Hachinami ba'avidte tarid. So the same thing, there's no particular proof that you would be allowed to look at a new dress. Maybe you wouldn't be. Maybe a regular person would not be allowed to because it could lead to hirhur. However, a person whose job is to work with such things, a laundry man, a tailor, or whatever, would be allowed to because that's his job.
So that's what I was saying before.
Sort of.
You make an exception for
right.
It sounded like from before though that it's only if it's warm.
Rav Chista was arguing that on the basis of that it has to be that way, because otherwise how would he be allowed to give it to them to fix up in the first place? And the answer is you don't necessarily have a proof in that. Maybe a person who's whose profession is not to do these things is not allowed to look at new dresses.
I thought the far before was that because he already saw it on her before.
That's what we were saying before. That was the argument that we were saying before. However, now we're saying not necessarily. It could even be before they're worn. There might still be an issue with it as well. Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Olamar, getting back to what we said in the Blight, the Menemeth. We said that the Malachamavet has a sword with the bitter drop dripping off it, and from that the person dies. So the Gemara says, name a Fligadav or a Shmuel.
He always kills with a sword, he doesn't kill with other things.
Well, again, a sword being a metaphor for the fact that a Malachamavet killed a person. But the Gemara is going to say in a second that when a person dies, and we're talking about a person dies naturally. We're not talking about when we say, for example, a person is killed in battle or what have you. Obviously, there's no bitter drop that causes them to decay and whatever. There, it's just that talking about a natural death. That a person dies in their bed, then we're saying that that's it. And we use the metaphor of a sword means, in other words, that means something that kills. But the Gemara is going to actually say in a second. The Gemara is going to take that metaphor to a bit of a literal sense to say that when a person dies, it's actually a form of shchita.
Shchita?
Yeah, we're going to. Yeah, one second. So, name a pliga davur de Shmuel. Should we say this that we're saying that the bitter drop from the Malachamavet sword is what killed the person? Should we say that Braisa then disagrees with what the father of Shmuel says? The Amar Avor de Shmuel, because Avor de Shmuel, the father of Shmuel said. By the way, are you guys familiar with the story why he's called Avor de Shmuel? His real name was Abba Bar Abba. Almost never in the Gemara is he actually called that. So the gist of the story, the Gaonim tell the story, I think Rashi mentioned it someplace, I don't remember. The gist of the story is that one time Avor de Shmuel, but this is before Shmuel was even conceived, but so he was one time away on a business trip, and a prominent Goyish lady tried to seduce him to be Mizana with her, saying that I see that you're a great person and I want to have your children, basically. So he Bederach, something else. What she tells him, I think, is something like, she says, I see with my kishur that you're destined tonight to father a child who's going to grow up to be a very great person. I want to be the mother of that child. Well, he was too far away, Bederach HaTeva, to be able to get home to his own wife, but he used a shame, he used a name of Hashem, or name of Malachim, or whatever, got home that night by Kfitzas HaDerach, had relations with his wife, and then went back to his trip. She became pregnant, and then the baby eventually with Shmuel. Meanwhile, nobody except she and he knew that he had been in town, because he came and left. So when Shmuel's mother is shown as pregnant, people thought that she'd been Mizana. They actually brought her to Beis Din and gave her Malchus. As Shmuel later on said, when he was older, I felt those Malchus right there in the womb. But anyway, he survived, she survived, and eventually, when he was born, everybody managed to Abu Shmuel came home, and everybody found out what the truth was. I don't know, but whatever it is, eventually they found it out, and therefore, maybe that was part of it, whatever it is, eventually, from then on, they called him Abu Shmuel to represent that he really is this child's father. Nobody should have any suffix on it, and he deserves to be because of what he did in order to accomplish it. Anyway, so Avur de Shmuel says, Amali Malachamava, so the Malachamava said to me, Eloid Chayshina Liyakoda de Biryasa, if it weren't for the fact that I am sensitive to the covered of human beings, have a parina based on Shchita Kibahema. If it weren't, you could say that.
Sensitive to the covered of human
beings?
Yes,
he's sensitive in the sense that, if not for that, have a parina based on Shchita Kibahema. If not for that, I would uncover the place where I shech them like an animal. In other words, when you shech. Okay, but the point is, the Malach HaMavis is given the responsibility to do it. The Malach HaMavis is given the responsibility to do the bitter drop, etc. So therefore, he's saying that if it were up to me, I would, when a person dies, he would actually have the cuts in his neck would be exposed like a behemoth. However, because I have respect for the covered of human beings, I don't do that. So we see, therefore, in other words, we can describe the way that a Malach HaMavis kills a person is by shchita, not by a bitter drop. So what are you telling me that he dies from bitter drop? The answer is Duma. He tipa machat holos simanim. Maybe you could answer. You could reconcile them by saying that bitter drop destroys the simanim, which is, in other words, a form of shchita. One thing is, you know, we talk about in Chassidus that shchita of an animal is actually you're raising it to a higher level of kedusha. In b'shachat elo moshach, when a person dies, is also right. So, you know, ideally, their neshama is now returning back to going back up on high to Gan Eden, etc. So maybe that's the connection the Gemara is saying over here between a person dying and shchita. That on the face of it, it should be that when a person dies, you should clearly see that it was a shchita. But that's not how it happens. Anyway, so the point is there's no necessary contradiction between what Avodah Shmuel is saying and what the Braisa is saying, because what the Kippah accomplishes can be described in terms of Shchita as well, in the sense that it destroys the Simanim. Okay.
If there would be more than a drop of blood, Shchita would give you much more blood.
Maybe not necessarily. The truth is there's a Mishnah in Cholin that... I can tell you that there's a Mishnah in Cholin that describes a scenario where you shech an animal and no blood comes out, and it has implications as far as Allah is a Tumah V'Tahara. So, yeah, I suppose, I don't know how it could happen, but I suppose it could happen. Fine. Continuing, we said in the Braisa, Mimena Mastriach, we said the result of that drop of one of the results of that drop from the Malach HaMavis sword is that the body decays. We must have Messiah Rav Chanina Bar Kahana. That statement supports what Rav Chanina Bar Kahana says. The Amr Rav Chanina Bar Kahana, Amri Bei Rav, they say in the Yeshiva of Rav, Haroitza Shalo Yastriach, if somebody wants that the body should not decay, or at least not as fast, that his relative or whoever who's dead should not spoil, he should turn him face down. And that way the body doesn't spoil as fast. Now, we're not talking about while the person is almost dead, then the halacha is not allowed to move him at all. So we'd be talking about either beforehand, or we'd be talking about, I guess, maybe after the person is dead. Well, maybe not, actually. We're saying, yeah. If the moment he dies, then the drop goes in. So it would have to be before he's a goitis. Because once he's a goitis, once he's near death, the halacha is not allowed to move him at all. Because any that's like a flickering candle, it says that in the Shulchan Aruch, like even the slightest touch can kill them. Yeah. Okay. Turn it up on them. We learn in a Braisa. Obviously. Okay. Turn it up on them. We learn in a Braisa. The Pasuk says, the same Pasuk that we quoted before, when Shmarutim is called Dovar Ra, you should guard yourself from any bad thing, which is what we said before, to do various, just to stay away from various things that could lead to you, that could lead you to hear her, to improper thought. So it also means, Shalo Yahara, Odom Bayoim, Vyavalide Tumam Balaila. It also means that a person should not be thinking thoughts, of Hira Avera by day, that will bring him to Tumma, that will bring him to Keri by night. Mikan Omer Pinchas Ben Yair, based on this, Pinchas Ben Yair said, well, if you're seeing that the Torah is telling you to be careful by day so that you don't have Keri by night, then we see from that, Torah is a famous Braisa, Rav Pinchas Ben Yair. We also have it at the end of Sota and a couple of other places. There's many stories about Rav Pinchas Ben Yair. We'll have some of them. We'll have some of them in Kulin, Be'ez Hashem. We'll have some of them in a few months' time, Be'ez Hashem. But yeah, okay. So Rav Pinchas Ben Yair said, Torah mevili de, and there's many different stories of this Braisa over here. You can see in a few places in this Braisa, you have parentheses and marginal notes and whatever. So yeah, okay. So Rav Pinchas Ben Yair says, Torah mevili de zehirus. Torah brings you to carefulness because that the Torah is telling you that you're to be careful to avoid the situation where you're going to come to Tumah. Also, Rashi says when you're oisik in Torah, when you're involved in learning Torah, then you understand what's allowed, what's not allowed, and you keep away from it. So Torah brings you to that. Zehirus mevi'ah l'idei zrizus. Being careful brings you to zrizus, to being quick about it. So Rashi actually seems to have the gears the other way around. Zrizus, Rashi explains, means when the person is careful to not come to a situation of avera. And zehirus would be if he ends up in a situation where there could be a potential avera, then he's careful to stay away from it. Many of the other, the gears that we have the other way around, zehirus before zrizus, so many mafoshim say the other way around. Zehirus means being careful not to get into a situation of avera, and zrizus means that a person is quick and full of energy and whatever to do the right thing. Zrizus may be the gain of kios. Then being zoriz, being quick quick and eager to do the right thing, brings you to nikius, to cleanliness. So Rashi says nikius, cleanliness means cleanliness of averus. When a person, yes, the cleanliness of averus. Some of the Mephoshim say it means literal cleanliness also. Or some of them say, for example, no, because when a person, because part of a person growing and they're in part of a person growing as a person and as a yid and as a Oved Hashem is to be physically clean.
Okay. That's not the point.
Right.
How does
Jesus
bring you to
Nikias? Okay, let's go through the whole thing, and then I'll tell you what Maharsha says about this represents. He says this whole Braise, he says, represents the Seder of a person's day, the proper order of a person's day. He says. So let's go through it, and then yeah. Okay. And by the way, I mean, there's many explanations about it. There's an entire Sefer Mesilas Yesharim, one of the famous Sifrei Moser, that's based on this Braisa over here that explains in detail what each of these levels means and what it means in Avoda and how a person reaches that level. And yeah. Okay. Nikius Mivir the day Precious. Cleanliness brings to Precious. So Rashi says Precious means staying away even from things that are Moser, that a person is Machmer himself. As a famous expression, brought Hayom Yom, Vasman Tornit, Terminit, Unvasman Megdat Minit, that whatever you're not allowed to do, you're definitely not allowed to do, is definitely off limits. Even what you are allowed to do, you don't have to do. That's Precious. So Nikius is that a person doesn't do anything that's awful. Precious then would mean that he, on top of that, he's Machmer and then controls himself even in the things that are Mutter.
The name Prushim
is related to that, because the name Prushim, the standard explanation of why they were called, of why the Chachamim in those times were called Prushim, is because they would stay away from the Amei Aretz. Because the Amei Aretz are Tomei Midrabanan, and various things about what they do are Tomei Midrabanan, and therefore the Prushim would avoid, as much as possible, physical contact with them. Prishus Mivile de Tahara. Prishus then brings Tahar. To tahara, to purity, which goes beyond nikius. Nikius is cleanliness, tahara is purity. One thing is, some of the Mephoshim explain, nikius is being clean in the things that are alpi seichel, that where the certain things that according to seichel you have to be clean and you have to be careful of. And tahara is beyond seichel, because the whole concept of tumah and tahara is a place. Tara mivila de chassidus. Purity brings to chassidus.
Chassidus in
Gemara terminology means going l'snim mishurat adin. It's related to the word chesed. So it means that the person goes l'snim mishurat adin, goes beyond the letter of the law and doing chesed for people. Chassidus mivila de anova. Chassidus then in turn, on the side of it here, again, it brings the gears, so not chassidus, but kedusha. It flips around kedusha and chassidus. So chassidus comes in the corner of that, comes later on, I'm saying. Okay, anyway, mivila de anova brings a person to be humble. Anova mivila de yirashet. Humility brings the fear of sin. Yirashet mivila de kedusha. That brings the person to holiness. Kedusha mevila de ruach hakodesh. The kedusha or chassidus, according to the different gersaris, brings a person to ruach hakodesh, to the level where he can experience ruach hakodesh, where the shechina can rest on him, as Rashi says. Ruach hakodesh mevila de tchias amesim, and ruach hakodesh brings to tchias amesim in the sense that once a person is on that level of having ruach hakodesh, on the simple meaning of it, as it means, such a person now has the ability to be mechaya amesim, to revive the dead. Okay, before we continue with Chassidus, there's a lot to talk about this. Marsha says that this whole thing of what Pinchas and Yair is saying is describing the proper seder of a person's day. The proper seder of a person's day. So he says like this: you start off with Torah, Zahirus. You have that right away. You get up. You're careful. You're careful about the mitzvahs of the Torah. So therefore, so when a person is like that, that brings him to Zrizus, where as soon as he wakes up, he right away gets up. He's not too lazy to get up, as it says at the beginning of Shulchan Aruch. But a person has to realize that Hashem is standing over him and get up quickly. So that brings him to Zrizus. Zrizos in turn brings to Nikius, which means partial cleanliness. A person washes Negovasa properly in the morning. Then that brings him to Prishus, and Marsha explains that Prishus means davening. Why? Because davening, in the olden days, they used to spread out their hands when they daven like this. Nowadays, we don't do that because that became a meaning of the goyim. But nevertheless, though, davening can be described as prishus, prisus, actually, then it would be with a sin. V'chapa prusus ha-shamayim. His hands were spread out.
They used to spread out
their hands like that to Hashem. Yeah. Eventually, it became a goyish minhag, so therefore Jews stopped doing it. But we find...
You should do it in davening.
Could be, I don't know. By the way, Marshall mentions in this connection, you mentioned the Purushim a minute ago. Marshall actually refers that also to people who daven properly are called Purushim.
Why?
Because for the same reason, because if we're saying that Purusha is spreading out of hands in davening, that's the proper posture for davening, then therefore the Purushim are people who are careful in davening. Okay. Anyway, so that's Purushim. Frishus then brings to Tahara, which is learning Torah in depth, because the person needs to be Tahar to learn properly. And that's how it should be, he says, because after all, it should be that you daven and then immediately you go to learn. You're supposed to be that you leave, as the Gemara says elsewhere, you leave the Beit HaKnesses and immediately go to the Beit HaMedrash, as the Gemara says at the end of Brachos. So that's Tahara. Tara brings to
Kedusha.
You learn a little bit before davening. I mean, in particular, you learn Chassidus before davening, but that's a preparation for davening rather than a Talmud Torah per se. But the idea is, after davening, this book we're learning. They say a vort on that. We ask in davening that Hashem should give us Chochma Bina Vadas in the Bracha HaTachonin. It's part of it. So therefore, if a person doesn't sit down to learn afterwards, so like what was he bothering after for? It's like knocking on the door, asking for something, and then going away before. Yeah. Okay. All right. So a person davens, then he learns. That's Tahara. Tahara then brings to Kedusha, which Kedusha refers to the way a person eats. That he eats in a holy way. That he washes his hands and he eats in a proper way. That brings to Anova, which is afterwards, after a person eats, then he goes out to do business. And instead of being a Balgaiver, instead he acts with humility around other people. That in turn brings to Yirashet, to fear sin, that now throughout the day when he's doing business, he's going to do business honestly and not anything that would be an Avera. That brings him to Chassidus.
That brings the chassidus, which again is going with Nimah Shura Badin, accepting Omar for Shemayim, and saying Krishna at night. That in turn, when a person then properly says Krishna at night, which is part of what chassidus is all about, Marisol says, then that brings the Ruach HaKodesh in the sense that such a person when he's sleeping,
normally you have a Ruach HaTumma comes out of a person when he's sleeping, that's why we wash Negev after in the morning. Instead, such a person has a spirit of Kedusha comes on him at night. And then that brings the Tchiyas HaMeisim in the sense that the next morning he wakes up and Hashem returns him his neshama. So Pasha describing how a person goes about his day, how a person sets himself up to begin with is how his day goes. And therefore he says that's why the Gemara stresses the idea that a person shouldn't be thinking hirhurim by day, which would lead him to petty by night, in the sense that that would be the opposite, where a person doesn't behave properly by day, and therefore he ends up with a ruach hatoma on him at night, a tuma of petty. That's why the Gemara stresses that point about by yom. There's also a chassidish avos that I once saw. I don't remember the source of it. The pasuk in Tehillim that says Yitziyativ al derech lo toiv ro lo yima. Supposing the person stands, talking about a rasha who stands on a no good path and doesn't hate evil. That the idea is a person is Yitziyativ al derech lo toiv. He stands up in the morning and then starts his day not in a good way, not by saying modani and washing negev after and so forth. Then inevitably, during the day, rolo yima, he's not going to be able to stay away from ra as he should. So it all depends on how a person starts his day. Getting back to the Gemara, chassidus gzeila mikolam. Chassidus is greater than any of the other levels that we mentioned before. Shenema oz dibarta b'chazim l'chassidecha. As you have a pasuk that says, then Hashem, you spoke in a vision to your chassidim. So it doesn't mention the yurei echa, to the ones who fear you, la'anavecha, to your humble ones. Rather, it mentions chassidim. So therefore, we see that that's the greatest thing. However, upliga de Rabbi Shurban Levi, however, that last point disagrees with something Rabbi Shurban Levi says. The Amr Rabbi Shurban Levi, I'm not observing the Kohen, because Rabbi Shurban Levi says that humility is the greatest of all these levels.
Chassidus.
Again, chassidus means going with the Nimashir of Sadin, and like Marshal says, it includes the way that a person goes about Kriyash Mashal
Amitza. So why would it be the greatest? Why wouldn't it be the end of the verse?
Well, according to, first of all, Rabbi Shurban Levi doesn't have to agree with this order of things in the Braisa. Again, I mean, you can try, you have different versions of this Braisa itself in different Gemaras. That's the thing. We're saying that he argues with Rabbi Shurban Levi, that Rabbi Shurban Levi says, another is the greatest of all of them. Shenema, Ruach Hashem Alekim Alayah, as you have a process in Shaya that says, the spirit of Hashem Alekim is on me, Yan Moshe Hashem Alekim Avastu Anovim, because Hashem has anointed me to give news, to give good news to the Anovim, to the humble one. Chassidim Lenema doesn't say to give the news to the Chassidim, El Anovim. Olamat Shanova Gerlim Mikolon, so we see that Anova is the greatest out of all of them. There's a sicha in Chelik Yud Gimel. He was an anav. So actually, yes, now that you mention it, there's a sicha in Bahaloska where the Rebbe in turn refers to something in Torah Ur that talks about that actually there's different levels of anava and there's different levels of anava. So there's different levels of anava, one which is below chassidus and one which is above it. You have an anava which comes mitzad tam v'daf, that a person has a reason to feel humble. The classical thing, for a classical example of that, for example, with Moshe Rabbeinu, that look how much I accomplished. He knows how much he accomplished. But if there was somebody else in my position and with my talents and with my yichus and whatever, he would have been able to accomplish much more. That's an anava based on tam v'daf. Nice. And then you have an anava which is higher than tam v'daf, which is beyond any rational count. He doesn't give an example over there, I don't think, but there is such a thing. So that would be higher than chassidus. So the Pinchas Ben Yair and Rabbi Shurban Levi are talking about different levels of anava. Okay, going back now to the Mishnah, we said in the Mishnah Ein Mochin Lahantula that we're not allowed to sell them anything attached to the ground to a goy. However, then Rabbi Yehuda said you're allowed to sell them something which is attached on condition that they cut it down. So let's analyze that. Tana Rabbana, we learn in a Braisa. Mochin Lahan Ilan Amunaf Lochutz V'Koytet. You can sell a goy a tree on condition that he will chop it down, and then he'll actually chop it down. Do Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says such a thing is allowed. Rabbi Meir says you're only allowed to sell them a tree that's already chopped down.
No condition.
No condition. Similarly, shachas, you're allowed to sell them. You're allowed to sell them very unripe grain. So you have to the point when the grain is grown, you already have it starting to develop stalks, but the kernels haven't really developed yet. So at that point, you could harvest it then and use it as animal feed, like hay or something. So the same thing, shachas, almanach ligzos or goyzes, you would be allowed to sell a field of shachas to a goy, the shachas itself, that is, on condition that he will cut it, if it goyzes, and then he actually cuts it, give it of Yehuda. The mayor again says that you can only sell them the shachas, the hay, after it's already cut. Now, why we need different machlokes, and on the same point, the Gemara is going to get into in a couple of lines. Similarly, koma almanach ligzo, you can sell a goy, standing grain. Here we're talking about after the grain has already ripened and it's already ready to be harvested. You could, or almost ready, whatever. You can sell it to him on condition that he will harvest it, recoiter, and then he harvests it, give it a yoda. The mayor again says you can only sell him it after it's already harvested. So why do we need three machlokes on the same point? We need to be told all three of them. Iyashmin and Elon, because if we were only told the machlokes in the case of a tree, you would say Bahakam and a mayor, only in that case is your mayor saying that you're not allowed to sell him the tree while it's attached to the ground, you have to chop it down first. Kivin the like posted, because a tree is not gonna get wound, it's not gonna deteriorate if you let it stay attached to the ground. Mashile, so therefore maybe the mayor wouldn't be concerned that what's going to happen, you're going to sell the goy the tree on condition he cuts it down, and he's going to say, okay, but I'm in no hurry to cut it down. I may as well wait another 6 months, another year, another 10 years or whatever, and then it would be a problem. Avalhai, but when it comes to shachas, when it comes to the unripe grain, where you can't leave it for too long, because then it won't be usable as animal food anymore, well, it'll mature, it'll develop into grain, and then you can't use it as shachas anymore. So with that, in other words, there is a time limit. If he mashi like pocket, if he leaves it too long, it will get ruined. It won't be usable for his purposes. Aim a modulator of Rabbi Yehuda. So maybe you could argue he would agree with Rabbi Yehuda that it's okay to sell it to him attached to the ground because he can't leave it more than another week or two without cutting it. The Iyashmin and Bahani Tauti, then if we were only told about those two cases, about the tree and the shachas, you would argue, Mishim Dolod Yediyah Shib Chayu. You would argue that true, but you can't necessarily evaluate, you can't necessarily put a dollar value on how much they're improving as long as they're attached to the ground. The middle one that we were saying was the grain. Sorry, it's not shachas that you can leave it and eventually it'll spoil. We're talking about the grain. You can't leave once the grain is mature, once the grain is ripe. Shachas is unripe grain. So we listed them. What we're saying is like this. The mayor, if we only had the case of the tree, then we would say a tree you could leave indefinitely. But ripe grain, the third case that we had, comma, ripe grain, how long can you leave it? Eventually it's going to be overripe and you can't leave it anymore. So then you would think the mayor is makeable on that. But no, if we were told only those two, we would say, Mishum Zula Yudhiya Shikhai. Fine, but you can't put a dollar, you can't really put, it's not really noticeable that, it's not really noticeable that there is an improvement in them being attached to the ground. Of course, a tree improves the longer it's attached to the ground, but you can't necessarily look at it from day to day or from week to week or whatever and say, look, I see that it really did improve, that I'm glad I left it there because now it's more improved than it was before. Same thing with grain. Once it's ripe, it doesn't really ripen any further. Aval shachas, but when it comes to shachas, unripe grain, where you can see that the longer you leave it, the better it is, because that's how it is. The more you leave it, the more it grows. The taller it gets, the more you have it. Aim a modulated a mayor. You would think just the opposite. Maybe Yehuda would agree with the mayor in that case, that if you sell shachas to a goy, he's likely to try to leave it in the ground as long as possible, so that it will improve. As opposed to, again, with the tree or the ripe grain, okay, in principle, yes, he could leave the tree indefinitely, but it's not necessarily like if he waits an extra little while, it's going to necessarily be noticeably better. So therefore, we need all those three cases. And on the other hand, the Iyashmin and Bahar, on the other hand, if we only had that one case of Shachas, then you would say Bahar, comma, the mayor, only in that case, maybe the mayor says that you're not allowed to sell it to him attached to the ground, Abba Bahana, but with the other two, aim a modulator of Yehuda, maybe he would agree with Yehuda, therefore Tzricha, therefore we need all those cases. Now, Tosfos asks in that case, all we need then is we only need two out of the three. We mentioned Shachas, we mention the comma, and we don't need to mention the trees. And the answer is Tosfos says it's a very common thing for a Braisa, for a Mishnah, or a Braisa to list things in a way called loizu achzu. Not only this, but even that. Not only a tree, where it's more obvious that you shouldn't be allowed to sell it to him, but even shachas or ripe grain, where it's less obvious, nevertheless the same thing applies. It's a common way of doing it. Yeah, show how far he goes. Okay. So now we have a question. Fine. So we've established that the mayor is saying that you're not allowed to sell it to them b'chlal, and Rabbi Yehuda, oh, no, unless it's already harvested, and Rabbi Yehuda says you are as long as the condition is that they're going to. What about the Hema'a Manach L'Shchet Ma'a? What about, we learned earlier in our parak that you're not allowed to sell certain kinds of animals to goyim, large animals anytime, and small animals depending on the minhag. What about if you sell them an animal on condition that they're going to shecht it? Ma'a, what would be the deal? Do we say, Hosam time am I shorter of Yehuda? In our case, in our Mishnah, why is Rabbi Yehuda saying you're allowed to sell it to him attached to the ground on condition that he chops it down? The lav rishus is tiny, because after all, it's not in the goy's rishus. You sold him only one tree, for example. The land around it belongs to you. So therefore, you could argue he has no ability to leave it growing there for too long. If he leaves it for too long, you're going to tell him, hey, I told you that I only sold it to you on condition that you're going to chop it down within the next week or whatever, and you're not keeping your end of the bargain.
Mine again,
no, not as mine again, but in other words, don't cut it down, or I'm going to avoid the sale. Yeah. So that you could argue in that case, Rabbi Yehuda allows it. But when it comes to an animal, it is now, after all, on the goy's land, on his property. Yeah, what are you going to do? Mashallah, maybe there's a concern that the goy may not keep his end of the bargain and may keep the animal, and you'd have a problem with that. Or jumal or shno, maybe there's no difference. Maybe either way, as long as he made it tonight, it's allowed. Tashma, we'll prove from a price, is a tanya. Rabbi Yehuda says that you can sell him an animal on condition that he shafts it, as long as he shafts it. Give it to Rabbi Yehuda. So says Rabbi Yehuda. The mayor says you're only allowed to sell him an animal that's already shechted. So the same machlokas in our Mishnah, as far as things attached to the ground, the same machlokas would apply as far as animals. Again.
What's the solution if he sells it to the goy and the goy doesn't want to shecht it?
Well, that's the point. According to the mayor, therefore you're not allowed to do that in the first
place.
So Rabbi Yehuda would say the condition is you sell it to him on condition that he shechts. And if he doesn't, then you tell him, well, you didn't keep your end of the bargain, therefore the sale is void. And I'll take you to court to get it back. Or whatever. Who is the halacha like again? So we talked yesterday that the Rif says the halacha is like a mayor because we have a Stam Mishnah like him.
Right.
On the other hand, most of the Rishonim, the Rambam, and most of the others say that the halacha is like a Yehuda, because usually the halacha is like a Yehuda against the mayor, and that's how it's brought in Shulchan Aruch. You are allowed to sell him a tree attached to the ground or an animal or a manasseh or shecht it or whatever, as long as the deal is that he's going to shecht it or chop it down or what have you.
Well, why are the two the same? Isn't the problem with the tree that it's attached to the ground and you can't sell the land?
So the problem with selling them a tree is that we said before, we don't want to make it possible for them to live on a permanent basis in the land. If they don't own anything attached to the land, of necessity, they're not going to live here for very long. They'll live here for a while. They haven't put down roots, and therefore they're going to go move someplace else.
The animal
is not attached to the ground. We talked about earlier in the parak, there's a different issue with selling animals to goyim, namely that we had issues where it can happen that you rent the animal to a goy or lend it to him and he does malacha with it on Shabbos, which is also because it's your animal. You can have a problem where you sell it to him right before Shabbos. And that was a different thing that's only right before their holidays, because they might bring in the carbon. That's a different thing. But you have an issue that you might sell it to them right before Shabbos, and then you're telling the animal to go because the goy wants to check it out, and then you're being over on the dinim of Shabbos, so you're not allowed to make an animal carry a burden on Shabbos. So for those kinds of reasons, you're not allowed to sell them an animal. So that's the thing. Here we're talking about, if you explicitly said that they have to shecht it, then Rabbi Yehuda is saying that's allowed. Mishnah says, Ein maskil lahem batin be'Eretz Yisrael. You are not allowed to rent a house to a goy in Eretz Yisrael. Because Rashi says, since you're not allowed to sell it to them, because again, that would be giving them chanoya b'karka, that would be giving them the ability to settle in Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, make a gzera that you shouldn't rent it to them. So we'll talk about soon. The fact is, you see that nowadays everybody rents and sells houses to goyim. So wait, we'll get there. The Ein Tzarich Lohem Asodes, needless to say, you're not allowed to sell them a field because, as the Gemara will point out, not only are you giving them Chanoya B'Karka, but also now you're making this field. It's not going to be Chayev in Mitzvah Saplo Yisbarat. Shmita is not going to apply to it. Shema and Maisa aren't going to apply to it, etc. Well, with Syria, however, in Syria, which are the areas in Syria and northeast of Eretz Israel, more north and northeast of Eretz Israel, that David conquered. Now, those places, Syria is only like semi-Eretz Israel because David conquered it, and it's called Kibush Yachid. It's called an individual conquest in the sense that David conquered it without the permission of the Sanhedrin. Normally, in order, if you conquer land, if a Jewish king conquers land with the permission of the Sanhedrin, then it becomes an extension of Eretz Yisrael. But in this case, he didn't have the permission of the Sanhedrin because he conquered it before Eretz Yisrael itself was completely conquered. Parts of Eretz Yisrael proper was still in the hands of the Goyim and David's time.
Why did he conquer it?
He conquered it because the kings over there were dangerous to the Jewish people, and therefore he conquered it. So fine, the Sanhedrin authorized him to fight against them, but not to annex their land to Eretz Yisrael. The famous expression is that they said to him, you didn't even conquer the areas near your own palace because parts of your Yerushalayim itself were still in Goy's hands at that time. So what are you doing conquering foreign countries?
But he wouldn't need permission to annex that if those other parts were already part of Eretz Yisrael.
No, so that's the thing. They weren't part of Eretz Yisrael.
The parts that were.
Oh, right. Right, so that's the thing. He hadn't gotten around to conquering all of Eretz Israel yet from the original seven nations. So therefore now, if he's going and conquering Syria, then it's considered, it's called Kibush Yachad. It's considered a conquest by an individual and it doesn't have before. So it has like a semi-Kibush, it's like halfway between Eretz Israel and Kibush.
Well,
what? He did it for defensive purposes. That's fine and good. But as far as the Sanhedrin is concerned, what he should have done is he should have made these places tributary to Eretz Israel. They have to pay tribute. They have to be under governors appointed by Jews or whatever, but not to try and annex it to Eretz Israel.
Can't you say that the fact that he conquered them enabled him afterwards to take the other land in Eretz Israel by protecting
But it didn't. But it didn't, because the fact of the matter is, you see that near the end of David's life, when he came near the end of David's life, he had to, what did we say? He had to buy the place of the Hanabayas, my Ravna HaYavusi, my Ravna, the Goy, the Yavusi. So we see that parts of Yerushalayim even were still in the hands of Goyim in his time. Yeah. So over Syria, Maskirim Lahem Basim, you're allowed to rent houses to Goyim because even on a Daraisa level, there's no problem with selling them to them because whatever Syria is. So it depends, various areas of Syria and parts of Lebanon and maybe parts of Iraq, whatever. Yeah. Anyway, so you're allowed to rent to them houses. We're not worried about that you may come to sell to them, because even if you do, it's not also Daraisa. But you're not allowed to sell them, you're not allowed to rent them fields, again, because then you do have the problem that, like this, these fields would have been chayiv in Mitzvah Saflurius Varetz, at least on a Darabonim level, and now you're taking that away. In Chutz La'aretz, you're allowed to sell them houses, and you're allowed to rent them fields. Divrei Rav Meir, so says Rav Meir. Rav Yossi is more makel than that. He says that Eretz Yisrael maskirim lehem basim avaloi sodes. In Eretz Yisrael, you're allowed to rent them houses, but you're not allowed to rent them fields, because houses, he says, that's not considered chanoya b'karka. You're only renting it to them. You're not selling it to them. We'll see in the next Mishnah. The next Mishnah is going to mention certain exceptions. When we say selling them houses, we have to figure out what the purpose of those houses is. Is it to live in, or is it for storage, or whatever? But we'll get to that. So I should say houses, really, but buildings. Or maskirin sodis, avaloi sodis, but you're not allowed to rent them fields in Eretz Yisrael. Or with Syria, merchin, batim, maskirin sodis. In Syria, you would be allowed to sell them buildings. You would be allowed to rent them fields. Over Chutz La'aretz, merchin, elav elav, and in Chutz La'aretz, you would be able to sell either one. However, actually, it's not the next mission, it's right over here. After makom she'omru la'am, even in the places where you're allowed to rent them a building, loyal base zero omru, we're not talking about renting it to them in order to live in. Because the goy is going to bring getchkes, is going to bring idols into the house. And the house belongs to you. Because it's your house. That we said, we learned, we established earlier in the parak that renting it to them is not the equivalent of a sale. Shenema lo sovi tayev el besecha. The pasuk says, don't bring disgusting things into your house. So you're not allowed to make it that there's going to be avodah zarah brought into a house that belongs to you. In all places, Eretz Yisrael or Syria, you're not allowed to rent to a Goya bathhouse because it's still called by the name of the original owner, and therefore when it's used on Shabbos, people are going to think that he's doing it on behalf of the Yid, which we'll learn about the details of that tomorrow.
Something you could apply it today.
Okay, so what is the din nowadays? So the fact of the matter is... So 1 second. So Tosfos talks about at the end of the Omud over here, the fact of the matter is we do see that people do rent and sell houses to goyim, even for houses, even for actual living quarters. So Tosfos discusses a few places. Maybe we're talking about that only if they bring in avodah zarah b'tzvius as a permanent thing. Not necessarily. Nowadays, Tosfos says, or the goyim that we live among don't have avodah zarah on permanent display in their house. They bring it in when a person is sick or whatever. They don't necessarily have it on permanent.
They have statues and they have
statues. Hold on. Tosfos isn't talking about Buddhas, because they didn't have Hindus and Buddhists among them in Europe.
This
is relevant. So today, Pater, if it's a Hindu or Buddhist, you might have an issue on that ground, because they do have it in their house. But you also have to ask, actually, which of these statues, even among the Buddhists or whatever, which ones do they worship versus which ones do they have as decoration? A guy has a Buddha statue in his house, doesn't necessarily mean he's bowing to it.
Have them as worship.
So if they have it as worship, that would be an issue. But with this, one thing Tosfos is saying is that the goyim among whom we live don't necessarily bring in avodah zarah permanently into their house.
They have icons.
Okay. Also, fine. Icons aren't necessarily avodah zarah. Tosfos talked about at the beginning of the Sechta that, for example, they have their various saints. Those aren't necessarily considered objects of avodah zarah. They respect them. They hold holidays or whatever in their honor, but they're not necessarily themselves avodah zarah. Yoshka himself, and crucifixes and whatever would be avodah zarah. Not necessarily like pictures of saints or whatever, but.
So what do you do if you rent them and they have Yoshka?
So first of all, there's one point that Tosfos says that not necessarily do they bring it in permanently. Another point Tosfos says is that maybe outside Eretz Yisrael, it's not really considered your house in the first place. And so therefore, you can't be considered that you're bringing Te'eva into your house. It's not really yours in the first place. And in fact, the Shach talks about, the Tosfos continues to talk about it on various grounds about it, but the Shach points out that as a matter of fact, for example, we're saying over here in our Gemara that rental is not like a sale, and there are implications about that in Halacha, because for example, in Bava Metzia, you have a Halacha. Let's say you rent somebody a house. And then you yourself, your own house, you the landlord, your house collapses or otherwise becomes unusable. The halacha is you're allowed to evict the tenant because why should you be living in a place that belongs to me when I don't have a place to live? However, the Shach points out, now, first of all, we pay taxes to the goyim, so that's one thing. It's not, in that sense, it's not ours. But number two is also they don't hold like that in their laws. In their laws, you don't have, if you rent somebody a house and then your house becomes unusable, that you're allowed to kick them out. So therefore, in that sense, you can't consider that the rental is really different than a sale. Essentially, it is much more like a sale in goyim law. Therefore, it's not bringing up a desire into your house
because you can't
easily evict them. But therefore, so that's another reason. So that's another reason to be not there. That sounds like I started my rip already, so I guess we'll continue with the Gemara tomorrow.
Last thing you said right before the Mishnah about the animals. They're giving the animal, once the animal's in the hand of the Jew, there's a possibility for many more mitzvahs done to this animal.
Not really, actually, because, I mean, aside from that, obviously you could check it and eat it, but aside from that, it's not really. I mean, no. Because when it comes to mitzvah saplurius ba'aretz, the mitzvah is actually on that piece of land. This piece of land needs to rest during Shemitah. It needs to have trumas and maizras taken from its produce, etc. There's no particular mitzvah on the animal. It's a mitzvah. You want to eat meat, make sure to check the animal properly, etc. The mitzvah is not really on the animal, per se.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Got it. Yeah. Huh. Good.